Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On this week's show, if only they found the round table. Archaeologists uncover the remains of mighty steeds of noble knights.
We could actually tell, based on the long bones, how good the bone is. So like a strong, sturdy, thick bone. And they needed to be strong and sturdy in order to carry the knights with all the armor.
And polar bears who can't get out on the ice to hunt seals are feasting on nesting bird colonies.
I really was quite surprised at just how chaotic bear foraging events were within the colony. You get a sense of it on the ground, but with that bird's eye view, you really see the impact of the bears.
Plus, pollution means pollinators can't smell the roses, how the Europa Clipper mission might detect signs of life, and who needs Atlantis, searching the seabed for real lost landscapes. All this today on Quirks and Quarks. Horses were an important part of life in the Middle Ages. They were used for agriculture, transportation of goods, and the migration of people. But if you think of medieval horses, you probably think of the mighty war horse, with an armored knight astride it, preparing to joust at a tournament. But in truth, we know little about the medieval war horse, at least from an archaeological perspective. For various reasons, remains of these mighty animals have been rare finds. So when an entire horse cemetery was discovered on Elberton Street near Buckingham Palace in the 1990s, scientists were chomping at the bit to learn about the animals buried there and what that can tell us about life in medieval England. Archaeologist Catherine Caney was one of the researchers studying these horses. She's a postdoctoral research fellow in the School of Archaeology at University College Dublin. Dr. Caney, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Tell me about the site where these horses were buried. What was special about it?
Horse cemeteries are exceedingly rare, especially in England. People stopped being buried with horses at all after Anglo-Saxon period. So at this time in the late 14th, early 15th century, there's very much not a presence of horses in any human burials, and they're certainly not generally formalized cemeteries. The only parallel to it is a ditch or a gully at Windsor Palace where partial remains of 8 horses were placed, but it wasn't like a formal cemetery. Here we've got, you know, just if you can imagine, if you bury a pet, that's what the horse burials looked like when they were excavated. And some of them had multiple horses in them, and some of them only had single horses.
How many horses were found at this site?
70 horses. Wow. And 197 pits. Yes, absolutely unprecedented.
Well, what is it about that particular location that all these horses were buried there?
Partially, we think that its proximity to Westminster and the tilt yard or jousting yard that was there might have played a role in that. There was some laws passed also to prohibit people from just tossing dead animals and dead animals like horses, which are quite large, into open construction areas. So it was a problem of disposing of animals. Plus, they were in close proximity to probably knackers that would take skins or other parts of animals and use them to make tools, make any sort of variety of items.
So how do these horses compare to other horses from that same period?
The average height of medieval horses from the period, from the mid-14th to 15th century, was about 13 hands high. The horses at Elberton averaged 13.2, but what was really surprising was that they generally skewed to the tall end of all of the horses in medieval England. We had 3 of the tallest individuals were found at Elberton. So 14.2 hands to 15.3, which is the exceptional outlier.
15 hands, that's 1.5 meters tall?
Yeah, roughly 1.5 meters. And you think about, if you see modern police horses, they're like 16'2". If you see horses in the Olympics, most of those horses are 16 hands or above. In the later post-medieval period, horses started getting a lot taller. And we typically have or think about horses today in that sort of category. But in most medieval periods, they were quite small. Height wasn't necessarily a huge advantage.
So generally, they were pretty big and healthy.
Big and healthy and robust. That was the other thing we found. We could actually tell based on the long bones how good the bone is. So, like, if you see, a lot of horse people talk about a good bone in a horse, and that just means a strong, sturdy, thick bone. And they needed to be strong and sturdy in order to carry the knights with all the armor. And so that was one priority that people were looking for in terms of conformation. Not necessarily hugely tall, but just a strong, sturdy, big-bodied horse that can handle the rigors of the activities in battle and in jousting.
Well, how did you go about analyzing these horse remains and figure out what they were used for?
Well, it was a fun adventure. So the first thing to do is inventory what you have and then start to do additional measurements and look for any pathologies in the bones. Is there evidence of arthritis? Is there evidence for injury, fracture, those sorts of things? We do also the isotopic analysis and genetic analyses. You take samples of the teeth and bone. So for the teeth, we take thin slices with a dental drill and then basically put them into pocky puck sized circle and fill that with epoxy. And then that goes off to be analyzed by the mass spectrometer. And what that is as the enamel forms in both horses and people and any sort of other animals, it absorbs the bedrock geology as the person or animal eats and drinks. So the bedrock geology varies in lots of places, and you get a number that will show you if the animal is local to that environment or not local to that environment.
Okay. So when you put all of that together, analyzing the bones, the DNA, and the teeth, what did you come up with, the origin and the use of these horses?
It was pretty astonishing. A minimum of 7 of them were from outside of Britain. So we know that not only do we have some horses that were not local to Britain, the island, we also had some that moved in pretty unusual ways. One of the benefits of this type of isotope analysis that we did is that you get very precise movements of an animal in a landscape if they're moving to different places that have different geologies.
So what does this say to you about horse trading during medieval times?
So it was a lively business, absolutely. It was absolutely an obsession of the crown and the aristocracy to procure the best quality animals they possibly could. And they did this in multiple markets across the continent and also somewhat within the UK.
What evidence did you find that tells you how these horses were used?
And that comes down back to the bones. So in the spines is where you see evidence of horses being ridden. In riding, you have the thoracic, lower thoracic vertebra to the lumbar spine. So think about like kind of right above your low back. That's the area where a person sits on a horse. And their withers, kind of that lump right before the mane, that is kind of the top of the spine into the cervical vertebrae, which make the neck. And if they're driven, you get more pathology there. If they're ridden, you get it more where a human would sit. What was also interesting about that is that the saddle design changed. So we're able to actually see it kind of skew towards the lower into the lumbar vertebra. So that indicates that the kinds of saddles that people were using, aristocrats and people in jousting tournaments and in battle, kind of shifted the human weight backwards, and that matches the spinal pathologies. The bit wear was the other thing that was absolutely interesting. And that is shown by wear on the teeth from the bit. So if you're familiar with the horse's mouth, their incisors are in front, and then there's a break in their mouth before the premolars. And what happens when you put a bit in their mouth is that sometimes rubs up against the second lower second premolars, and it makes an obvious amount of wear. What was absolutely fascinating is that that kind of bit wear is only associated with a curb bit, which was used in highly trained horses by the elite that were able to afford those horses and afford that kind of bit. So we're able to see those things in the horse bones.
Well, now that you've been able to put the story together of these large elite horses from medieval times, what's your next step?
So there's ongoing research with the horses from the rest of the sites that we worked on, and we are continuing with the isotope and genetic research. There's additional ongoing genetic research to look at trading and rearing and genetic relationships between the horses at Elberton as well as the horses from around the UK. And so the work continues.
Dr. Caney, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a great pleasure, Bob.
Dr. Catherine Caney is a postdoctoral research fellow in the School of Archaeology at University College Dublin. As the climate changes, animals are having to change with it to survive. Polar bears are one high-profile example because the sea ice where they prefer to spend their time hunting seals is melting away. Without this ice, the bears are increasingly having to forage on land in order to find whatever food they can. Berries, kelp, and even nesting birds and their eggs. But this, in turn, leads to adaptations as the rest of the creatures in the ecosystem respond to new behavior from its top predators. That was the surprising finding of a team of researchers who used drones to study feeding dynamics in the Arctic. While watching polar bears dine and dash their way through a nesting colony of eider ducks, they noticed that herring gulls were closely following the action to snatch up any leftovers that might be around. Dr. Andrew Barnes is a postdoctoral fellow who works with the University of Victoria and the University of Windsor. He led the study. Dr. Barnes, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
Paint me a picture of the egg colony. What's it like?
So this work was done on East Bay Island, up on Southampton Island in Nunavut. And this is a fairly dense nesting eider colony that's been studied for a long time, long before I came along. And there's, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of eider nests nesting there each year. And for the past 10 or so years, polar bears have been visiting these this island every year and just scooping up as many eggs as they can get.
Boy. So the nests are on the ground and the polar bears just stomping through them.
Right. Yes. Sorry. Eiders are ground nesting ducks. They lay clutches of, you know, anywhere from to 1 to 5 big, bright green eggs. Their nests are really, really well insulated. You know, for an Arctic nesting bird, you want to keep your eggs nice and warm. Eider down is incredibly insulated, and they want to stay on their nests as long as they can throughout the incubation period to keep their eggs warm and successfully hatch ducklings.
Well, tell me about your drone footage. What did you see looking down from above?
Yeah, so the research team before me was originally interested in the energetics of polar bears feeding on seabird eggs, and they were using drone video of bears foraging in these bird colonies to estimate how many eggs bears were consuming and how many calories they could gain from those eggs. When we reviewed the drone footage of bears foraging in the colony, one of the interesting things that we noticed was herring gulls, an avian predator in the ecosystem, seemed to be following bears around the colony as they moved from eider nest to eider nest and using bears basically as a way to get at eider eggs.
Well, take me through that. How does that work?
Right. As bears are moving through the colony, you know, they're a big, scary predator. And, you know, poor little nesting eider sees bears approaching and they get off their nest in response to these bears. I mean, bears are large predators and, you know, eiders are, you know, potentially fearful of bears. So once eiders leave their nest, their eggs are entirely unprotected from bears, but also gulls. So normally gulls can't get at eider eggs because of the nesting parents who are there to defend their nest. But once they flee from polar bears, those eggs are entirely open and available to gulls.
Oh, I see. So the bear is kind of acting like security guards pushing a crowd back so that the gulls can come down and get the eggs.
Yeah, in a sense. You think about a bear moving through a colony, it's a big, scary predator. And, you know, it just results in hundreds of available eider nests free for the picking for gulls who don't normally have access to this many eggs.
Were you surprised by this?
I really was quite surprised at just how chaotic bear foraging events were within the colony. You get a sense of it on the ground, but with that bird's eye view, you really see the impact of the bears in the colony.
So is this a new behavior in the polar bears to go around stealing eggs from eider ducks?
Not necessarily. The behavior of bears foraging on Arctic bird eggs has been known about for a long time. Bears would occasionally come onto land and get a few eggs here and there. But what is new is the frequency of this behavior. As climate change continues to warm the planet, sea ice goes out earlier each year, and bears find themselves on land more often. So it's more of a regular behavior now.
Mm. Well, what impact is it having both on the ducks that are laying the eggs and the gulls that are following the birds around? Have their behaviors changed?
Right, yeah. So my original interests as a graduate student were on the behavioral responses of birds to foraging bears. And as I moved into a postdoc position, I continued that line of research with eiders. And we found that, you know, as bears were moving through the colony, it was just creating this huge panic of eiders just flying off their nests in response to big, scary bears. For gulls, you know, it just creates huge foraging opportunities that they wouldn't necessarily have. So gulls are pretty smart. We've all seen gulls forage, and they're quite clever birds. They see a bear foraging or walking on land, you know, they can cue in on that pretty easily and go check out what's going on. So, you know, as a behavioral adaptation, I think it's pretty neat for gulls.
Are the gulls interacting with the bears at all?
Yeah, in an indirect way. So as a bear moves through the colony and is picking up eider nests, gulls seem like they were more willing to visit nests behind bears rather than directly in front of them. So if we go back to your security guard analogy, as a bear is moving through the colony and pushing eiders off their nests, there's some nests that are available in front of the bear and there's some that are behind. But gulls didn't want to visit the ones in front of the bear. And I suspect this is because gulls actually see bears as a bit of a threat. I mean, again, they're a big, scary predator, and they represent a huge risk to gulls.
Right. Well, I can understand not wanting to be in front of a hungry polar bear.
Yeah, exactly. You and me both.
So what do you think the long-term effects of this behavior of having two predators, the polar bear and the gulls, and their effect on the eider ducks?
It's a bad time to be an eider. Not only are you stuck with tough Arctic nesting conditions, you have to contend with a very hungry large mammal predator, but now you also have to deal with the secondary avian predators that could swoop in and pick up anything that bears might have missed.
Do any nests survive these attacks?
It seems for the most part that most of the nests on East Bay Island are failing each year as a result of bears. But what's interesting here is previously we thought like, oh, okay, well, the bear's in the colony and all the nests are failing. That must be the bear getting all of those eggs. What's new here is that we suspect that at least some of these nests are getting consumed by gulls. So while all the nests are failing due to the polar bear, it's not just the polar bear that's getting those eggs. It's a combination of the bears and the gulls. Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of stories on this program about interconnections in nature where one change affects another change. And here we got polar bears, gulls, eider ducks all interacting. What's that say to you?
Yeah, it speaks to the complexity of nature, right? So, you know, when we first started investigating this as a scientific community, you know, polar bears are on land and they're scooping up nesting bird eggs. And, okay, well, this is probably bad for birds. But we're really starting to get a better picture of the broader ecological effects of this. And just as you say, you know, there are these trickle-down effects. So bears being on land consuming nesting bird eggs has impacts on the secondary predator community. And what will be interesting down the line to think about, well, okay, well, what does this do to species that are now connected to that secondary predator community? So, you know, what is the impact on gulls and what is the impact now on species connected to those gulls as well?
So the bears are changing their behavior. The gulls are changing. Do you think the eiders will change their behavior as well?
For the Eider's sake, I hope so. There's been some interesting work trying to predict what Eiders are going to do through simulation modeling. And one idea is that instead of nesting in these great big dense colonies, Eiders are potentially going to switch to nesting in smaller, less dense colonies throughout the Arctic, basically in a bet hedging strategy. So if you're nesting in a big, large colony and a bear finds you, well, chances are most individuals in that colony are going to fail because of the bear. So it might be a better strategy to nest in less dense areas and just hope that a bear doesn't find your colony. Hmm.
Dr. Barnes, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Dr. Andrew Barnes is a postdoctoral fellow with the University of Victoria. This fall, NASA will launch the Europa Clipper spacecraft to Jupiter's ice-covered moon, Europa, which is believed to harbor an ocean with more water than exists in all the oceans on Earth. And on Earth, where there's water, there's life. Here's the head of NASA's Science Mission Directorate's Planetary Science Division, Dr. Lori Glaze, at the South by Southwest Conference in early March.
And so this mission, Clipper, is really designed to not necessarily look for the signs of life, but to actually look for the different things that you need for life. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be exploring with, I think, 9 major instruments that are going to look for how deep is that ocean, how salty is that ocean, how thick is the icy crust.
Now, they may not be looking directly for signs of life, but it turns out maybe they could. In a new study, scientists in Berlin demonstrated that it is possible for one of the spacecraft's instruments to detect bits of life from a single grain of ice. Dr. Fabian Klenner led the study. He's currently a postdoctoral researcher in planetary science and astrobiology at the University of Washington. Hello, Dr. Klenner. Welcome to our program.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
What will the Europa Clipper mission be doing that you were interested in?
There's one instrument on board Europa Clipper that's a mass spectrometer, the so-called surface dust analyzer, and this instrument will be capable of analyzing single ice grains that are in Europa's vicinity.
Single ice grains, well, how will the spacecraft be sampling them?
So the spacecraft will flying by Europa with speeds between 4 and 6 kilometers per second. And this works in a way that these single ice grains impact the metal target of the instrument, generating positively charged and negatively charged ions, which can then be analyzed using mass spectrometry. So this gives you information about the composition of these grains.
Where are these ice grains coming from?
Europa is continuously bombarded with micrometeoroids. And these impacts of these tiny micrometeoroids, they are lifting these tiny ice grains, so that Europa itself is always shrouded in a tenuous cloud of icy particles. And in addition to that, we don't know that yet, but Europa Clipper will certainly find that out if there are active plumes like the ones on Saturn's moon Enceladus. And if that's the case, then there is another source of ice grains.
Oh, I see. So these little grains got blasted off the surface and the spacecraft is going to fly through this cloud. Is that the idea?
Yes, exactly.
So how did you simulate capturing one of the ice grains in your laboratory?
The thing is that simulating exactly that process is on Earth technically, let's say, extremely challenging. So what we do instead is we were using a tiny liquid water beam, which is in a similar size range as the ice grains are. And we injected this water beam into a vacuum, and this water beam then disintegrates into droplets after a few millimeters. And we prepared our samples in a way that we have, in theory, one bacterial cell in one water droplet. And then we were using a laser. We fired a laser onto these single water droplets, creating positively charged and negatively charged ions. And then we were using the same analytical tool, mass spectrometry, to analyze the composition, so which ions were created. And the data that we get in the lab can be compared with the data that will be sent back by Europa Clipper.
So your laser beam was simulating the speed of the spacecraft to blast the ice particles apart.
Yes, so we can tune our instrument. our experimental setting in the lab in a way that we can mimic different impact speeds of ice grains onto these metal targets in space.
And what did you find when you analyzed the remains?
That was quite exciting. So when you analyze the positively charged ions, we find them amino acids and metabolites of the bacterial cells. And in the negatively charged ions, then we see fatty acids, which are lipid fragments from the bacterial cells. So we see really fragments, we see a lot of signals in our data, which are definitely from the bacterial cells.
So if the Clipper spacecraft detected any of those, how would that indicate that Europa has life in it?
If that's really the case, and Europa Clipper would, let's say, multiple times detect the biosignatures that we found in our lab data, then this would certainly be a very strong indication of life.
What aspects of life are these molecules, the fatty acids and the amino acids?
Yeah, so the cell itself is encapsulated in a lipid membrane. And let's imagine the cell impacts the metal plate in space, and then it breaks apart and things get charged. And then the fatty acids come from the lipid membrane around the cell, and the amino acids come from the inner part of the cells.
Usually when we hear people talking about searching for life, they're looking for DNA or RNA, but you seem to be looking for the pieces of the cell itself, fatty acids and things.
Yes, so that's what we found in our lab data. And what we find in our lab data is believed to be also seen in space when this instrument on board Europa Clipper would, in theory, detect these molecules. So I'm really excited to look for fatty acids because they appear to be a bit more stable than DNA. That's in our experiments.
Mm-hmm. How many of those ice grains can Clipper detect and analyze at one time?
So it depends on altitude and speed and on the exact flux of the ice grains. But the instrument on board Europa Clipper is, in theory, capable of detecting, let's say, 10,000 of grains if it turns out that there is a plume similar to the one on Saturn's moon Enceladus, where you have huge fluxes of ice grains. So whenever the instrument is switched on and it detects ice grains from, let's say, regions above Europa that are very interesting because we believe there could be organic chemistry or other interesting things, and then we would find something like the data we created in the lab, then I can well imagine that flybys will be tweaked in a way that we get again to these locations.
So if you find these fatty acids, metabolites, and amino acids, is that definitive proof of life, or do we have to go one step beyond that?
I think to have a definite proof of life, you will probably need more instruments. But if we would, in theory, detect multiple times these signatures in the spectra, then of course you have to ask the question, where should it come from if it's not a bacterial cell? And that's actually exactly what we've proven in our lab setup, that these instruments are capable of detecting bacterial cells.
So if the spacecraft finds fatty acids, you can come in and say, hey, I know what that is. We did that.
Yeah, exactly. That's the purpose.
Dr. Klenner, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I was really excited talking to you.
Dr. Fabian Klenner is a postdoctoral researcher in planetary science and astrobiology at the University of Washington.
Are vegans actually unhealthy? Does cannabis ruin your sleep? And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1. Coming up later in the program, an Australian Atlantis, a sunken landscape, reveals its secrets.
And then as we come into the last ice age, at that point, sea levels fell to about negative 120 metres. And then we see the entirety of this now submerged landscape exposed, and people actually would have been able to live right across it.
The human footprint on Earth is drastically changing the environment. It's even transforming the sensory experience of animals living alongside us, and not in a good way. Underwater, we make a huge racket with our shipping that can disturb whales and fish. After the sun sets, we're polluting our surroundings with artificial light. And, of course, the smells. Where we go, we tend to leave a bouquet of vehicle exhausts and industrial emissions that linger in the air we breathe. Whew. Sometimes you can even taste it. Now, in a new study, scientists found that air pollution is interfering with the smells that plants emit, impeding pollinators' ability to sniff them out. Dr. Jeremy Chan led the study. He's a postdoctoral researcher studying pollination ecology at the University of Naples in Italy. Hello, and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Hi, Bob. Thank you for having me.
First of all, how do pollinators use their sense of smell to locate and track down flowers?
The antennae are the olfactory organs, well, one of the main olfactory organ on insects. And so these pollinators use their antennae to sniff the air for scent trails, which they can then find to locate flowers.
Well, how did you investigate how air pollution can interfere with the pollinators finding their flowers?
The first step involved sampling the scent of those flowers. And then we analyzed those scent samples using a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, and that allowed us to identify the different chemicals that were present in the scent.
So once you created the scent, what pollinators or what insects were you interested in testing, how well they were sensitive to that?
Yes, first we had to figure out which were the relevant pollinators, and we found that many, many different pollinators visit these flowers both during the daytime and at night, many species of bees, flies, butterflies, moths. And so we did some exclusion experiments and found that it was the nocturnal pollinators that were the more significant pollinators of these flowers. In particular, they were the hawk moth pollinators, these giant, sometimes we call them hummingbird moths because they sound and hover like hummingbirds. And yes, we investigated the impacts of air pollution on the ability of these moths to recognize and locate sources of these floral scents.
Well, tell me about your experimental setup. How did you do that to test the moths and their sensitivity to the chemicals that you created to represent the flower scent?
So first, we conducted antennograms on the moths, where we did electrical recordings of the neuronal signals from the moth antennae. And this is in response to different components of the floral scent. And so we using these electroantennograms, we identified chemical components of the scent that the moths were responsive to. And so once we had this done, we could create a scent blend of the important chemicals in the scent. And then we did wind tunnel behavioral experiments where we measured the proportion of moths that were able to navigate the wind tunnel to locate a source of floral scent that was either pristine or which was degraded by some combination of ozone and nitrate radicals.
Wow. Now, you mentioned antennograms. You were able to actually tap into the antenna of the moth to detect what it was smelling?
Yes, actually. Literally connect electrodes across the antenna to measure the electric signals.
Wow. Well, how sensitive were the moths first just to the flower scent?
Oh, well, these moths are amazing. I think they have some of the most sensitive olfactory systems known. The Hylis lineata, or the hummingbird moth, was sensitive down to maybe a thousandfold dilution of the scent. And I think the tobacco hornworm moth might have been sensitive down to a 10,000 times dilution. So these are exquisitely sensitive pollinators with really exquisitely sensitive olfactory systems.
So once you tested their sensitivity to the flower scent, what pollutants or contaminants were you testing to see how that would affect their sensitivity?
So I was testing the reactive components of air pollution. So in particular, the ozone and nitrogen oxides, which can react to form nitrate radicals, which are really highly reactive in the atmosphere.
So how do the pollinators respond once you introduce those into the flower scent?
when we introduced ozone, equivalent to what we would find in, let's say, a highly polluted city, large city, we found that after about a minute of reaction time, the scent was significantly degraded, but the pollinators were still able to recognize the scent. But in the presence of nitrate radicals, again, equivalent to what you would find in a heavily polluted city, after a minute of reaction with the floral scent, the pollinators failed to recognize the scent.
So they were not detecting the flowers at all?
I would say that they were smelling something, but they were not recognizing that smell as the smell of a flower. I mean, it still smelled like something, just not like a flower.
Oh, I see. So the pollution actually changes the scent of the flower to the insect.
To everything. I mean, when I smell the degraded scent, it also smells different to me. So the key here is that there are many, many tens, sometimes hundreds of different chemicals in flower scent, and all of them have different reactivities towards ozone and nitrate radicals in the atmosphere. And so the more reactive components of the scent get reacted away, this changes the scent profile such that it smells like something else.
So this isn't really affecting the moth. It's not changing anything in the moth. It's just changing the scent, and that's what the moth is reacting to.
So that is what my study was investigating. Mm-hmm. There's other research studying the impact of ozone and other pollutants on the pollinators. And there is an impact on the pollinators as well, which is actually an added impact of these pollutants.
Boy. So what are the implications if pollinators can't locate flowers because of air pollution?
In the case of the system that I studied, I calculated that there would be an approximately 28% decrease in fruit production in the plant that I studied as a result of such pollution.
So what does that mean for both the flowers and the insects?
It's possible that we might get a population decline of the flowers. And if that happens, that will in turn affect the food source for these pollinators and other insects and animals that depend on those plants. And so it will kind of be a feedback.
When it comes to pollution, usually it's the pollution itself that we smell. We don't think about the lack of good smells from the flowers that we're missing.
Yes.
Dr. Chan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Bob.
Dr. Jeremy Chan is a postdoctoral researcher in pollination ecology at the University of Naples. Atlantis, the lost continent. A fabled ancient city-state, the glory of the ancient world. Tragically lost beneath the sea, existing now only in legend. Atlantis is probably the best-known story of a civilization lost beneath the waves. Stories of great floods wiping out ancient civilizations are almost ubiquitous in mythology around the world. But increasingly, we don't really need those myths. Geologists and archaeologists have uncovered real evidence of inundated landscapes and even drowned civilizations from prehistoric times. We know, for example, about Beringia, the vast landscape that joined Alaska and Siberia during the last ice age, inhabited by the ancestors of the first people in the Americas. And there's increasing evidence of human occupation down the west coast of North America more than 10,000 years ago, all sunk beneath the waves when the end of the ice age caused sea levels to rise more than 100 meters. Well, now, on the other side of the planet, we have evidence of an Australian Atlantis, a nation-sized region researchers believe to have been home to up to 500,000 people for tens of thousands of years, before it disappeared beneath the waves. Cassie Norman is an archaeologist and a PhD candidate at Griffith University in Brisbane, Australia. Hello and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Hi, it's nice to be on board.
First of all, how did you find this underwater area?
Basically, in the last few years, Geoscience Australia has spent a lot of time doing underwater mapping of our submerged continental shelves, and they release this and make it public. So once this data set became available and it was much, much higher resolution than anything we've had access to before, I really jumped onto that and went, wow, you know, we can really start to pick up on this incredible underwater landscape that was once dry land in the last ice age.
Wow. Where is it located?
It's an enormous extension of the Sahul continental shelf. So the Sahul continental shelf used to connect New Guinea and Australia into a supercontinent in the last ice age. And so at that time, basically this region that we're investigating is this massive area of land that connects Arnhem Land and the Kimberley, which are our two really ancient occupation landscapes that we have in Australia. And it stretched out over 500 kilometres towards the Indonesian island of Timor. So just this incredible, enormous, remarkable landscape that once hugely enlarged that region of Australia.
Wow. So was this a land bridge between Australia and the islands to the north?
No, but it did make Australia much, much closer to those Indonesian islands. So at about the last ice age in the LGN, it would have been about 80 kilometres crossing distance, which is significantly less than it is today.
And how large was it?
Well, our estimates place it at about, at maximum land exposure when sea levels were at their lowest, it was about 1.6 times larger than the United Kingdom is today. So we're talking about a really significant area of land that just isn't there any longer.
Well, how did you go about reconstructing its topography and what it used to look like?
Well, once we got hold of that really high-resolution maps of the ocean floor, I was able to put it into these really cool computer software that we have access to, and that visualizes that topographic data for you in very, very high detail. And then we were able to go in and basically do like an underwater exploration. And then we were able to map past sea level heights onto that landscape to see the way that rising and falling sea levels actually interacted with it and transformed it from archipelagos to a huge submerged shelf with a massive inland sea. And that just sort of kept changing through time as sea levels fluctuated.
Oh, so sea levels fluctuated. Is that how it came above land or was exposed?
Yes. So about 70,000 years ago, sea levels fell low enough that for the very first time, an enormous archipelago emerged that basically stretched out towards the island of Timor. And then as we come more into marine isotope stage 3, which is a slightly warmer and wetter period, sea levels rose again and sort of drowned that region a bit more. And then as we come into the last ice age, at that point, sea levels fell to about negative 120 metres. And then we see the entirety of this now submerged landscape exposed, and people actually would have been able to live right across it.
Oh, that's quite different from the science fiction movies that show Atlantis as the island sinking. It's not the land going up and down, it's the water going up and down.
Yes, exactly.
What did you see when you analyzed it? Like, what kind of a landscape was it when it was dry land?
It depends on the time period we're looking at. As I said, at about between 70 to 60,000 years ago, which was when we first see people in Australia, we have this gigantic archipelago of islands, hundreds of islands that stretched out in this huge half circle and then a huge embayment in the middle of them before you get onto the current Australian landmass. And then at the last ice age, we see this enormous landscape stretching out towards Timor, and it has a massive inland sea called the Melita Sea. And what you also see is surrounded by these huge sloping plains with massive river systems draining the continent into the inland sea. So in the past, this just would have been this very, very diverse, very complex, and very habitable landscape.
Boy, sounds spectacular. Now, what made you think that people could have lived there at that time?
Well, we've got multiple lines of evidence. The first is that we had a couple of demographic modellers, and they were able to estimate that the potential carrying capacity of the shelf fluctuated from about 50,000 people to a maximum potential carrying capacity of 500,000 people during the last ice age when you have the full shelf exposed. Before, a couple of months ago, this was basically just an estimate. Like, we were basically saying the landscape could support a really large population at this time. And then there was a big genetic study that was published in Nature a couple of months ago, and they were looking at the genetic populations of people, Aboriginal Australians on the Tiwi Islands, that once would have been part of the shelf. And that genetic study also found that in the last ice age, the region held very large populations. It was basically a population spike. And then when we looked at the archaeological evidence, what we see is an increase in artifact discard rates at archaeological sites. So basically, there's more artifacts being deposited within the archaeological sites. And the way that's normally interpreted is that there's more people therefore leaving more objects, more things, more artifacts. And then this, the final line of evidence is that at that time, we see a big shift in the ancient rock art styles in the region. We suddenly see this completely new rock art style appear, which is anthropomorphic human figures, all sorts of different styles, but they're very, very similar through that period of time in Arnhem Land in the Kimberley. So we see this similar type of rock art style that's very different to anything we've seen before suddenly appear in those regions.
When you put all of that evidence together, what does that suggest to you as to who those people were?
I mean, they were Australia's First Nations people. And previously in the past, there was a lot more of Australia, a lot more of that supercontinent of Sahul. And of course, they've got this incredibly dynamic, diverse landscape. They're going to be out there living on it and using it. And then they had to adapt very rapidly to that very rapid period of warming and sea level rise that happened when the end of the last glacial occurred. And so what we see is this dynamic response to past climate change by Australia's First Nations people.
So what does this mean for our understanding of Australia and its Indigenous people today?
It means that it's very important to not just look at the landscape the way that it is today, but to consider the landscape as it was in the past and then build that into your migration models and your dispersal models and the way we think about human movement. So it's not static, it's incredibly dynamic and it fluctuated and it was very different in the past. And so we really do need to incorporate that into our models.
Ms. Norman, thank you so much for your time.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Cassie Norman is an archaeologist and PhD candidate at Griffith University in Brisbane, Australia. This story of an Australian Atlantis is fascinating, but lacks one key element: hard archaeological evidence left behind by people on the inundated landscape. Well, that's not true of a recent discovery on a lost landscape in the Baltics. In 2021, Dr. Jacob Gerson was leading a normal annual trip out into the Baltic Sea off the coast of Germany with his marine geophysics class, planning to do some routine mapping of the seafloor. But rather than the normal rock and silt, Dr. Gerson and his team saw something strange in their acoustic scans. 20 meters down, they found a structure. Something that didn't look exactly natural. Something that turned out to be extensive, even enormous. It took some time, but they eventually realized that this was a large, human-made artifact, like nothing ever found in Northern Europe. A long, inundated relic of a people that lived on the land many thousands of years ago. Dr. Gerson is a marine geologist at the Leibniz Institute for Baltic Sea Research. Hello and welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
First of all, tell me how you first saw this underwater structure.
Well, the first time we saw it was actually in the depth measurements, in the acoustic scans that you mentioned. And there we were just able to see that there was something on the seafloor, so obstacles, because we only had the depth measurements. And then the first time we saw it in video was a year later in 2022, when we lowered the camera and got the first videos or images of the rocks.
So what do they look like in the video?
Well, they look like the normal rocks or boulders that we are used to have here in Northern Europe. What was special in this case was the alignment, like that we have one rock next to the other over a distance of about a kilometer.
A kilometer long? Wow. Now, is this just a line of stones or is it actually a wall? Like, how tall is it?
It's not high, so it's less than half a meter usually. There are a couple of bigger rocks in between, but it's usually less than 50, 40 centimeters. It's not a proper wall, so it was not built, or we assume it was not built to keep animals inside, but rather to kind of guide them, to give them a direction in an open landscape.
Well, it may not be tall, but it's a kilometer long. That's a fairly big structure.
That's true, yeah. So a kilometer long, but not very high.
What made you think this was a human-made structure?
We haven't seen something similar. So we are used to seeing rocks at the seafloor, but they are usually randomly spaced. But that we have them aligned over a kilometer, that is kind of special. So that's what triggered something in me to also to go there again next year and to check what this could be.
So okay, somebody went to a lot of effort to line those stones up. But how did a man-made structure a kilometer long end up under 20 meters of water?
That's like all the land surrounding it here in the Baltic Sea and also partly in the North Sea, that was flooded during the last big transgression in the Baltic Sea. That was about 8,500 years when the ice melted, the glaciers melted, and kind of the sea level was rising after the last glacial maximum, and then the seafloor at 20 meter, that was flooded 8,500 years before present and then stayed submerged until now.
So how old then is the structure itself when this land was above sea level?
So if it's from the Stone Age, it's older than 8,500. But if it was used for hunting, and that's kind of the most likely explanation or functional interpretation that we are aware of, then it's probably even older, 10 or 11,000 years, because at 8,500, there was already forest. And in a forest environment, such a structure would not function for hunting, as you could get closer just hiding behind the trees. So it must have been built at a time before the forest came, and then we are at an age of 10 to 11,000.
Now, you talk about it might have been used for hunting. How would a line of stones help hunters do that?
Well, in an open landscape, it's difficult to get close to the animals. So these structures, and we know that also from onshore, there are structures that have survived in dry areas like in deserts or in Greenland. These structures were built to guide the animals either into a bottleneck situation, or they could guide these animals into the water, into a lake, as they are generally happy to swim, but they are slow, and that would allow them, the hunters, to get closer.
What animals were they hunting?
So here it's the reindeer, I think, in northern America. It's the caribou equivalent.
Huh. Well, those are fairly big animals. I mean, they could easily step over a line of stones that's less than a meter high or so. So why would they follow it like that?
I don't know what makes them follow it, but it turns out that they do. I mean, that from the biologists, it's still the same today. When you kind of chase these animals, they somehow get attracted by these linear structures, and then rather try to follow instead of crossing and stepping in between these rocks.
Wow.
For observational biology.
Now, what does this tell us then about the humans that were both constructing this kilometer long line of stones and hunting reindeer or caribou?
That's something we are kind of starting to investigate and hoping that we will learn about the people at that time, for example, how big the groups were and how stationary they were, hunting in small groups and that the overall group size was small. But maybe if they did the effort to build such a structure, that could be an indication that we may have to rethink the group size, and that at least for hunting, they may have met in bigger groups.
Well, obviously, it would take a large number of people to build a wall or a line of stones a kilometer long. And so, maybe they would have to get together at migration time when the animals are coming by, saying, let's all get together and do a group hunt.
Yeah, well, I guess they if they put the effort and built such a structure, as an indication that they maybe not just used it once, but kind of came back over the years.
Are there other structures like this in other parts of the world?
Yeah. Such structures did survive in the deserts, like or in dry places, or in Greenland, northern Norway, in the Great Basin, so western US. So wherever the population is low, there's a chance for these structures kind of to survive.
This cooperative hunting, we have a structure in Canada that's not a line of stones, it's a cliff called Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump. And people once a year would get together in large groups and herd animals over the edge of that cliff. And then they would slaughter them and skin them and get meat from them at the bottom. So it's a similar kind of cooperative hunting.
Yeah, it's a similar strategy. We don't have these huge cliffs after the glaciers retreated, but it's a similar situation to bring them, the animals, into a situation where they cannot escape. Yeah.
Dr. Garrison, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Dr. Jacob Garrison is a marine geologist at the Leibniz Institute for Baltic Sea Research. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca. Or just go to the contact link on our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks, where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast or get us on the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Rosie Fernandez, Olsi Sorokina, Amanda Buckowitz, and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebbins. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.